Herzlich willkommen bei Klinisch Relevant, deinem Wissenspartner für das Gesundheitswesen. Dreimal pro Woche, nämlich dienstags, donnerstags und samstags, versorgen wir dich mit unserem Podcast und bringen dir Fachwissen in deine klinische Praxis. Weitere Informationen und Angebote findest du auf unserer Webseite www.klinisch-relevant.de.
Heute hörst du wieder einen Podcast in englischer Sprache, der wie immer von Laura Reynolds gehostet wird. Sie spricht mit Dr. Stephanie Kosor über das Thema Sexual Health and Sexuality in Illness.
Viel Spaß beim Zuhören.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Klinisch Relevant in English. I'm your host, Laura Reynolds, and today I have Dr. Stephanie Kosor as my guest. Today we're going to touch on topics such as sexual health and sexuality in the context of illnesses and older age. Ina Blume and Cordula Winterhola did an episode about sexual health and language surrounding it from a speech therapy perspective, and they discuss what's happening in Denmark regarding this. If you haven't caught that episode yet, I would recommend going back and giving it a listen, if it's in the German language. But today we're going to discuss it all from the point of view of a doctor. And for this, I'm joined by Dr. Stephanie Kosor. She's a specialist in general practice with additional qualifications in medical psychodynamic psychotherapy and sexual medicine. She has a private practice for sexual, psychological and couples therapy in Berlin. And she is the author of the German language book Das Gute und Schlechtem Sex, wie Bindung, Kink und Konsens uns den Arsch retten können, which roughly translate to the good thing about bad sex, how attachment, kink and consent can save our arses. It discusses the most common sexual dysfunctions, special sexual preferences and where to find good sex therapy. Her perspective is feminist and inclusive. The book can be ordered from the Autorenwelt shop, and we'll put the link in the show notes. So welcome, Stephanie, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Sarah, for having me.
So I thought I would start and set the scene a little bit with the World Association for Sexual Health, WAS, has the Porto Proclamation on Sexual Health, Rights and Justice, which states that sexual health is an essential component of overall health, human dignity and development, and that sexual rights are a human right, and through sexual justice, we can achieve a more equal and inclusive world. So with this kind of in the background, I wanted to dive in and ask you, from your experience, what are common problems you hear from your patients regarding their sexual health or sexuality, and how do you counsel them?
Yeah, that's a very broad question, and the answer is two, because I do a lot of counseling on problems like erectile dysfunction or problems achieving climax or orgasms, problems with pain during intercourse or other sex practices. So the people are also asking about how to ask for consent, how to navigate consent for if they want to do some practices that are not normal or not like vanilla. They want to ask how they can navigate special requests or how they can open themselves about fantasies that they have never had done before. And another part is counseling on how to navigate relationships. Do we want to open the relationship? Should it be monogamous? How can I deal with jealousy or the more communication-focused problems? And depending on this, we together chose what the goal of the counsel is. So we try to find something that everyone can agree on. And sometimes that's a difficulty if there are couples and the one person wants this and the other wants that. There's part of the counseling process to find out what the common thing may be in this couple. And if it's more medical, if there's some illnesses or conditions, we try to find a way to deal with the consequences of a therapy or of a medication or an operation or something like that. And often it's time to say goodbye to something that was in the past and now is not possible anymore, and to grieve a little.
Yeah, would you come across many patients with illnesses, and how do you counsel them through that, maybe changing what they used to do or how they have to adapt to something new?
I find it very helpful to think of sexuality as a more broader concept, not only in terms of genitals and orgasms, but also in terms of connection, intimacy, and as it's kind of a body language, what you do in bed with another person. And often when we defocus genitals and focus more on how can we see each other in this condition, or how can we deal not with only the loss, but also with the possibilities that is, there are new perspectives, new opportunities that, there's a saying, limitation feeds creativity. So maybe this is something what helps people to find creative ways to deal with conditions. And your question, is it a lot? No, it's not, because I've unfortunately think that my practice has kind of a barrier, because that people have to pay for the counseling, and that the doctors, the general practitioners, or also in hospitals, they don't do a lot of sex medicine, and they don't counsel them on public health insurance. And so the people that come to me are normally relatively wealthy, and people that have disabilities or chronic illnesses are mostly or often poorer than the healthier population. And that's, I think that's a structural and societal problem that we have to face here.
Yeah, I was going to ask your opinion on that, actually. Do you think that healthcare professionals, doctors, are we educated in sexual health? Do we have the language around it? Are we trained to talk about it?
In Germany, I think it's really not as good as it could be. If we look at the Netherlands or Great Britain, there are some programs. The doctors are trained at least a little, at least basic training. There are guidelines on how to counsel patients. And in Germany, there's nothing, that it doesn't exist. There's a few universities like Charité that have basic training for students during medical during their studies, and sometimes you can only choose. It's like a Wahlfach, and you don't have to. It's not mandatory. And if I do a lot of workshops for doctors on how to speak, how to talk to patients on the topic, because there's a lot of shame, a lot of insecurity. We don't know how to do it, and it always feels like, maybe I'm crossing boundaries, like voyeuristic. Why do I have to ask this? I don't want to know. Is it even medical if I ask things about sexuality? And I always tell them, yes, it is. It's necessary. I know a lot of people that stop their medication because they fear sexual side effects, or if they fear that their sexuality is impaired from the medication or the therapy, and they don't talk about it. And we have to ask. Also, there are a lot of conditions when you take the erectile dysfunction, when your erection is not as hard or as reliable than earlier, and it's in every situation, it's during masturbation or in like the morning wood is gone, then you have to, that has a bell, a red flag, it's a bell that has to ring, because it's a sign for cardiac diseases or for the vessels that are maybe... there's a problem that leads, if we don't see it, if we don't see the erectile dysfunction as an early sign of cardiovascular disease, we see that after 3 to 5 years, the person has a heart attack, and we could have prevented that. So I think it's for mortality, it's good to talk about sexual functions or dysfunctions. Also, we are highly social, or the species of the humans is social, and we need other people to feel safe and to regulate, and to also our blood pressure depends on how we are held as babies and as adults and also as elder people. This is a resource that we don't use, and we could use the potential of relationships for prevention of cardiovascular diseases, or for the our immune system reacts on bad relationships, and there's more problems with autoimmune diseases when we don't have safe and secure relationships. And so I think it's a medical problem also with Einsamkeit. I don't know.
Loneliness.
With loneliness, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we have to address that as medical healthcare professionals.
Yeah, you touched on a few points. I want to dive a bit deeper. When I was researching for this episode, I was looking up, I started just with a generalized web search of sexual health guidelines. And I found that actually the most guidelines for sexual health cover STIs or contraception. And that was sort of it. I had to kind of go digging, because there's obviously far more to sexuality and sexual health than just STIs, prevention and treatment, and just contraception, i.e. the prevention of pregnancy. And I found there's guidelines from the European Association of Urology. They have a nice guideline on sexual and reproductive health. So that's more to do with males. And they did speak about the erectile dysfunction, which you've touched on as well. Saying that there is a significant increased risk of cardiovascular disease, coronary heart disease, stroke, atrial fibrillation, cardiovascular, and all-cause mortality. And I think, I mean, I wonder, do cardiologists or general practitioners who are trying to score their patients' risk of cardiovascular disease, are they routinely asking about erectile dysfunction?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is probably
sure
no. Yeah.
That's what I experienced.
But I also thought, from a wider public health and prevention standpoint, because ultimately, I think as doctors, we'd want to prevent disease. We'd rather patients don't have the consequences of an illness. We'd rather not meet them when we're trying to cure them or help them when they've already got the illness, but to prevent it. Obviously, there's a lot of public health campaigning around preventing stroke, preventing cardiovascular disease. But I'm wondering if, from a public health point of view, we could make it more sexy in a way, if we say things like, you know, do more sport, smoke less, if you want to keep your sex life active and healthy, if you want to prevent erectile dysfunction, because like it or not, that's emotive. You know, there is a lot of shame, embarrassment associated with that, even though it's quite common actually. But it's something that's not spoken about. And I'm wondering though, if it would hit home more to the general population if they thought, oh, I might get erectile dysfunction, as opposed to a heart attack, which kind of seems a bit like this idea that's kind of out there, you know, not really graspable.
Mm. So do you think it's more relatable to think about erectile dysfunction because everyone has experienced periods of difficulties with erectile dysfunctions rather than heart attacks that nobody had until they have?
I'm wondering, I'm curious. I'd be very curious to know if it would hit home, right? Like, because I think that's something that maybe is more tangible or more like they can empathize maybe a bit more with that. I'm curious.
I think it's a good idea. I don't want to threaten people because if they are anxious, they won't be able to make good decisions for their health. But the kind of motivation, your sex life is very important, or your relationships are protective. We want to have a look on that, or we want medically want to focus on relationships because it's important. I have a lot of patients that say, if you mention it as an important health topic, I can focus on building healthier relationships. And if I don't give an impression that I am able to talk about sex, or the patients can talk about sex with me, it's taboo, and they will not address it if there's something. And I think it's really good if every patient, every first appointment, you have to make an offer. Here is a place where you can talk about these topics, and it's also important for your overall health and maybe for your survival. So we want to highlight it in the as far as you want to. It's not I don't want to step across borders, I don't want to penetrate you with this, but it's important, and it's not, we don't have to be shameful about our sexuality. And also we can say, if a person functions normally in sexual terms, we can state that their autonomous nervous system and their hormonal system is relatively balanced. It would not work if there's something really off. So it's also very that you have an overview over the human being that is in front of you if you ask questions about sexual health.
Yeah, that's a good point to take away also. Yeah. Another point I wanted to touch on was what you have said as well about this communication and kind of providing this safe space. And if people want to talk about it, they can. Obviously, it is a topic that is quite taboo and people are apprehensive about discussing these things. And going back to you saying you provide workshops for some doctors, how to talk about it, because I was wondering, yeah, do you think us doctors, if we don't approach these topics, is it stemming from a position of us not knowing, of afraid to look stupid or incompetent, the societal expectation that we should know everything, that a person coming to us at this time, they're feeling uncertain, maybe fearful, maybe they've catastrophized their symptoms, maybe their symptoms are also like legitimate, but they're coming to you to look for an answer. And sometimes there can be this unforgivingness amongst people. I don't know if you've been in that position. I certainly have, where you hear people say, oh, even the doctor didn't even know what was going on with me. And I think that can be very hard as a doctor. But as you mentioned as well, in the university courses, sometimes sexual health is just a choice subject. It's not a mandatory subject. And yet, the Federal Institute of Public Health, which is an authority of the German Federal Ministry of Health, has Liebesleben, which is a website. They have public health campaigns. And they state that you have a right to education about sexual health from your healthcare provider. So I think that puts a lot of responsibility on us as healthcare providers to be able to talk about these topics, ask about these topics. And if you don't feel you have the competency or resources, be able to refer someone on further.
I think there are a lot of layers in that, because I personally find it very interesting to talk about sex. So I had to educate myself. There was no course in university or even in the Facharztweiterbildung. And in Germany, you have to want to know something about sexuality, and you learn automatically on hypertension or, I don't know, prostate cancer. We don't have, we have a more patriarchal or paternalistic way of counseling, or we had, maybe it's changing towards shared decision making or a more balanced communication style. But if we have the fear of feeling incompetent, or if we have to provide an answer or a solution, that is a lot of pressure on doctors. And I don't think it works for sexuality, because it's highly individual, the biographic or traumatic or sociological, societal imprints in every person is different, and you don't have to, it's not a hypertension pill or hypertension sport. There's not as easy to say one solution for one problem. It's rather more the communicative aspect. And I think that it's also what is missing in couples. We have to learn to communicate properly on sexual stuff. If it was normal to discuss, what do you want on your pizza? Do you want Hawaii or champignons? And just when you agree on let's have pizza, it's not the same for everyone. It's not, if let's have sex, it's not sex. And we have to learn how to communicate from doctors to patients, from patients to doctors, between people. And if we learn how not to be ashamed, it's easier. And also if it's easier if it's paid, if talking or counseling was paid in our medical system, there would be a lot more motivation, or it would not cost as much if you try to talk to people or listen more to people. And third or fourth, I don't know where it was, is that there is a lot of missing information. Since 2022, there's the clitoris in the anatomic books. We don't know, or we lost the knowledge, and there's a lot of there's a gap. We don't know a lot about our sexual organs and how it works, and if it's not in the textbooks, it cannot be in our knowledge, and we cannot transfer it to patients, and we have to puzzle ourselves through the literature, and it's not easy to find proper and valid information.
That's crazy to think, isn't it? First, since 2022, that it's in the books. That's it's shameful in some respects, isn't it? In this day and age, but thank God, better late than never, I suppose.
True.
I mean, I'm really glad we are having this conversation, because I know that I think about these things, and I also feel like sometimes I am not equipped, or also wondering, I suppose, whose responsibility is it? You know, is it, say, my responsibility in a more acute hospital setting, or, you know, where you're trying to put out the fires of, you know, a person just having a hip operation, for example. But I have often wondered, okay, like, you know, fine, we're seeing them at a point where they're kind of just learning to walk again, or that's difficult, but at some point that will no longer be difficult, and presumably these people will want to have a sexual life again. And, you know, what mechanically is possible after hip operation, or a person who's had open bowel surgery, who's left with a stoma, what is possible there? Or if a person has urinary incontinence, vaginal dryness, if they're older, do older people have particular needs that are different than younger people? And sometimes I wonder, because I'm not old, I don't think about these things. I don't know the answers. But I think it's something maybe as clinicians we need to think about, especially the older people. It's an aging population, and I think sexual health needs to continue on up into these older generations as well.
Yes, definitely, yes. You mentioned a lot of different conditions, and every illness, every operation, every therapy has its own implications for sexuality. And the guidelines recommend that we as doctors really try to take perspective of patients. What can change in sexuality if I put the hip in this person, or if I take the appendix out, or if I put a pouch or stoma or whatever, what can change? And I always ask my students or the doctors, please give me one example for an illness that doesn't change sexuality in any way. And there's nothing. I cannot imagine any condition that has no effect, be it better or worse. But everything can change the perspective or techniques of sexuality, or self-perception, or attractiveness, or perceived attractiveness, or relationship, or whatever. everything can have an impact. It doesn't have to have an impact, but it's possible. And we have to counsel them. Recently, I was at a conference and there was a surgeon, and I asked him if he told the patients for a pouch, if they want to have anal intercourse after it, he has to do it technically different so that there's space for the penis or the toy or whatever. And he said, no, I don't do this. And I was, okay, thanks for your honest answer. But you're taking away part of the sexuality of the person without telling or asking for it. That is rude, but it's not intended to be rude. It's just thoughtless, or he didn't think about it. And if every one of us would take the perspective of the patient, how would I feel if this was done to me regarding my sexuality? I think it could be helpful at the first.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. I think if you were to ask that question to that healthcare provider, I'm sure they would not be happy if someone would take away something from their sexual health. But I think it just goes to show the culture of medicine that sexual health is not a priority. It's not really taken seriously by us ourselves. This is all anecdotally, but you hear it through friends that they take medications and they complain about the side effects of a lower libido or such things. And because I just feel like because they're not these concrete, hard, objective complaints, that they're often pushed to the side and not really taken seriously, or, oh, just try a bit longer with this medication before we, you know, try you on a different one. Or it's also seen as that's the lesser of the two evils. Like, for example, if this hypothetical patient in your scenario getting the pouch, they're getting that for a reason, right? So I guess maybe from the point of view from the surgeon, he's like, well, I'm saving your life. So if you are not able to have anal sex again after that, well, isn't that a fine price to pay? I don't know. I don't think that's a good enough price to pay personally. I think, as we've said, this sexual health is important.
And also you have to, I think we have to counsel the patients. We have to tell them this, that, and this. There's the consequences. This is the benefits. This is the cost, the risks. You decide. It's not me. It's not my life. If anal intercourse is most important for you, and maybe you would rather take a stoma or another option, it's not me to decide. And it's, I don't feel... it's not my position to decide what's good for the patients. I can just put my expertise and say these are the options, and yeah, you choose. The medical or the side effects of medication is not studied properly because the companies don't ask structured for sexual side effects. Also, it's not tested with people with a cycle or menstrual cycles or people with no cycle, so we don't know how they work during ovulation or menstruation. As you said, there's not the hard facts like stroke or broken leg. You cannot count, and the questionnaires or the techniques to watch out for sexual side effects are also not as good. We have to talk to people, and that's nothing that is done in research. We want to have a blood work, or we want to have a CT scan or something that we can state. But I think in sexuality and in relationships, it's very important that also the emotions and the communication and the contact between the individuals is very important for our health, and that is underestimated for all these problems that I mentioned.
Yeah, a small anecdote on this is I know of somebody who accompanied their partner to an outpatient clinic. Their partner has a chronic illness which affects the genital region. And afterwards, obviously, they got the clinic letter which stated what happened during that consultation. And somewhere in the middle of it, it stated, yes, the patient has lots of issues sexually because of this. And she was like, what? This was, when was this? It was never mentioned. Like, yes, is it known that this illness is associated with a high level of psychological then stress regarding sexuality? Yes. But was it discussed in the consultation? No. And we were both just very curious, you know, is it, what's hindering it? Is it also just like the lack of knowledge of how to help, you know, that you don't know, you don't. But I think maybe sometimes it can be okay just to be able to listen, even if you don't have the answers, just to be able to hear it. What are the problems your patients are facing?
Yes, that's a very important topic. I think even, we as doctors are used to know things and to have a solution or to help. And in these spheres, we are not experienced, so we don't know how to help. We can just be a partner and listen to what their symptoms are and take them seriously. And maybe we can counsel on steps that to take, but if we feel helpless as doctors ourselves, that is nearly impossible to cope with, and we have to pretend that we know and to pretend that if we don't know, that's not a problem, or it's a psychological problem, just deal with it. And I find it very helpful to lean back. If I'm under pressure that I have to tell them something, how you can do this and that or the other, if I feel pressurized, I just lean back and say, this must be hard for you if you experience this. And that's so helpful for the patients to be heard, to be seen, and to be felt in a way. And even if I cannot change something about the genital region of the person, I can hear it and I can work on the relationship part of the problem, because that already lowers cortisol and the blood pressure. And I do preventional work if I just listen and regulate with them.
Yeah, I think that's a very universal point, no matter in what scenario, what illness you're dealing with. At the end of the day, people want to be heard. They want to be able to tell their story and have someone take it seriously. And I think that in itself is therapeutic and something I myself probably need to be reminded about. Often it's, not always easy, or you don't always think about it on the day to day, but it's important.
And we can do it. We are good at this as doctors.
That's true. Yeah. I feel like we have covered a lot. Is there any points you are wanting to get across to our listeners that we haven't touched on yet?
Yeah, I think the aspect of gender in medicine is also something that is helpful to watch, because male or people that are socialized male are different than females, and there's a gap in communication and also in outcome if the doctor is a male and the patient is female, regarding surgery or some regarding mortality. And I don't want to blame male doctors. I think there's something that we can learn, that communication and taking patients seriously can protect them, no matter the gender. It's just the starting point of this approach, that we as doctors matter for the outcome of the patients, and that we can make a difference when we listen, because female presenting patients are often taken seriously less than male persons. They get less pain medication and more psychopharmacy, and it's more on the psycho side. And sometimes it's right, sometimes it's not. And we have to be aware that societal norms are also sitting with us in the practice or in the counseling room.
Yeah, I'm really glad you touched on that point. I did a podcast in the past with Eleanor Cleghorn, who's the author of Unwell Women, and she describes the journey of women as patients in the healthcare system for the past number of centuries. I said it then, I'll say it again, it's an absolute must read for every healthcare practitioner. I think there's a lot of work to be done, but she did a fabulous job of shining a light on this, and thank you so much for bringing that point up as well. Definitely, I think it's a really important thing to keep in mind. Before we end, I just wanted to throw out a few points of reference if people are looking for more information. I did a bit of a search. These are the things I found. There's a Springer journal called Sexuality and Disability. It's a journal devoted to the psychological and medical aspects of sexuality in rehabilitation and community settings. They had some nice titles there about different illnesses and disabilities and sexual issues surrounding that. We have Liebes Leben, which is from the German Federal Institute of Public Health. Lots of education there. I mentioned the guidelines from the European Association of Urology, and there they have sexual and reproductive health guidelines. There's also the World Association for Sexual Health, WAS. They have a world meeting on sexual medicine in Porto in February 2026. So if you're interested in getting more information about sexual health, there could be a place to go, and hopefully more sunny than Germany. And obviously, Dr. Stephanie Kossow's book, The Das Gute an schlechtem Sex, wie Bindung, Kink und Konsens uns den Arsch retten können. So that would also be a place for information as well. Thank you so much, Stephanie, for joining. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Vielen Dank, dass du heute wieder zugehört hast und unser Gast gewesen bist. Wir hoffen sehr, dass dir dieser Beitrag gefallen hat und du etwas für deinen klinischen Alltag mitnehmen konntest. Wenn dem so sein sollte, dann freuen wir uns sehr über eine positive Bewertung bei Apple Podcasts. Falls du Lust hast mitzumachen und es einen Themenbereich gibt, in dem du dich besonders gut auskennst, dann melde dich doch gerne unter kontakt@klinisch-relevant.de. Gleiches gilt, wenn du Themenvorschläge oder konstruktive Kritik für uns hast. An dieser Stelle auch der Hinweis auf unseren Newsletter, den du unter www.klinisch-relevant.de abonnieren kannst und der dich immer auf dem Laufenden hält. Wenn du dich für unseren Newsletter einträgst, bekommst du einen 5-Euro-Gutschein, mit dem du in unserer Fortbildungsakademie einkaufen kannst. Wir wünschen dir jetzt bis zum nächsten Mal eine gute Zeit und freuen uns, wenn du bald wieder einschaltest. Pass auf dich auf, bleib gesund, bis zum nächsten Mal. Ciao.